During the 1988 Winter Olympics held in Calgary, Canada, there were two stories that seemed to dominate the public interest. Both of them had to do with underdogs. The first was Eddie the Eagle, a ski jumper from Great Britain whose actual name was Michael David Edwards. He was the first competitor since 1928 to represent Great Britain in ski jumping. Eddie finished last place in both the 70 and 90 meter events, but the public fell in love with his drive and passion to become an Olympic athlete. The other story was the Jamaican bobsled team. Jamaica had never had a team compete in the dangerous sport of bobsleigh and instantly became the underdogs whom everyone wanted to succeed. In fact, Disney made a movie about their story called Cool Runnings, starring the late John Candy. Well, during their final run down the track, I was only a mile away watching on television from a crowded pub in Calgary, Canada, not far from the university where I was a student. But late in the run, the Jamaicans lost control of the sled and crashed, never officially finishing. And when they did, a collective and audible sigh filled not only the pub I was in, but in living rooms around the world. But little did I know that as I watched the four Jamaicans walking down the track, that later in my life, I would be hanging out with one of them in Jamaica. His name is Devin Harris, and he has a remarkable story. Since his days on the bobsled slope, Devin has become a top corporate speaker and author, sharing his philosophy of keep on pushing and never stop dreaming with Fortune 100 companies all over the world. He's also the founder and CEO of the Keep On Pushing Foundation, which is a charity focused on helping children in disadvantaged communities receive a quality education. I reconnected again with Devin and asked him to come on the show where we talked about his crazy Olympic run, his time in the Army, as well as how he overcame all odds to become the inspirational success that he is today. Devin has some amazing advice for those of us who want to reach our true potential, regardless of where we're starting out. Devin, great to have you on the show. Really excited that you're here. And it's been so long since we've seen each other, all the way back to a cruise ship in Jamaica.
Well, bro, it's great to connect. You're right. It's been a long time, man. We met on the high seas.
We did. So for those listening, what happened was I was speaking at a conference and so was Devin. We were speaking at the same conference and it was a conference on a cruise ship. I've never done that before, but we were in the Caribbean.
Yeah, that was my first time. My first and dare I say only speaking cruise as well.
Yeah, I've never. It's pretty rare to do that, but of course, as Devin is, a celebrity in Jamaica. After he spoke, our next stop was Jamaica, and so I was like, "Man, I'm going to hang out with this guy." And so we had a fantastic day today, day together. I still remember. Man, actually,
I know I left us stranded on the Duns River Falls. I promise not to do that next time.
For sure. I remember us getting off the boat, actually. And as we were heading in, you know how everybody, all the taxi drivers come at you to get the tourists. And they just thought you were another tourist until you opened your mouth and they realize, oh, wait a minute, you're Jamaican. And then they realize, oh, you're Devin Harris. And so it was fun hanging out with the celebrity for the day.
It was fun hanging out with you guys and showing around not my hometown because I'm from Kingston, but certainly my home country.
Well, so here's the thing, like you're best known for being that first Jamaican bobsled team, but as with everyone, your story is so much bigger than that. And it obviously predates the Jamaican bobsled team. And you grew up actually in a pretty rough area in Kingston, right?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, a place called Olympic Gardens, bro. I often joke about the fact that certainly people here in the US will see these ads from the Jamaica Tourist Board, come to Jamaica and feel all right. I'm like, we do have those places in Jamaica, but they were not talking about my neighborhood, right? There's not much to feel all right about. But yeah, it was one of the tough, gritty, impoverished, violent neighborhood of Olympic Gardens, or Waterhouse, as we call it in Jamaica. Yeah, that's where it started for me.
So for you, one of the things I love about you is that you're so visionary. You have such a positive attitude. And where did that start? Did that start earlier on in life, or was that something that came later as you got out of that neighborhood?
You know, Jamie, whenever I'm asked this, I always go to my grandmother. I blame her. I spent my early years with her, until I was maybe five in rural Jamaica. And the thing I remember about her was that she was an amazing storyteller. And the stories that impacted me the most, I can't say I remember all the details, but the ones that that impacted me the most were the ones she told me about soldiers and these amazing things they could do, you know, and not get hurt. And it seemed impossible, but I thought, wow, I want to be a soldier. I'd like to do something like that. And that inspired me to want to join the army and become a soldier. But more importantly, though, what it did was that it inspired me to want to do things, take on, pursue results that other people thought were incredibly difficult, if not impossible. And I think that just that kind of stayed with me. She planted the seed and it has just grown since.
I think a lot of people don't know that about you, that you went into the Army and you served there for a lot of years. In fact, all while you were competing for bobsleigh, you were in the Army.
Yeah, I joke all the time, like, you know, I'm a trained killer with a killer smile, you know. But my first two Olympics were while I served. And so, yeah, you know, you go back to my grandmother's influence and her stories. And I wanted to join the Army. And then, you know, growing up in one of the tougher neighborhoods, discovered that you could actually enlist as an officer, which is typically not what guys from my background do. It just seemed, again, impossible. But I thought I'd go pursue that. And, you know, again, I guess they liked my smile and they selected me, allowed me into the officer corps of the Jamaica Defense Force. And I served for 8 years, retired as a captain after my second Olympics back in 92.
Well, you definitely have a million-dollar smile, that's for sure. And I'm sure that served you well in life. And in fact, but one of the best stories you told me, I'm going to ask you about it in just a moment, but it had to do with not the Olympics per se, but actually your time in the Army. But I wanted to ask you that, you know, you have an amazing message. Keep on pushing. I still mm-hmm. remember watching you speak from the stage in the ballroom of this luxury ship that we are on. And you're talking about keep on pushing, but you talk a lot about the power of dreams, about the power of having vision in your life. And where did that come from for you? Was that also your grandmother?
Again, you know, I think that's where it started, right? If she is telling me about these impossible things that soldiers are doing, and it fired up my little imagination that maybe I could do some amazing things as well. And so as you know, I'm growing up and I tell the story of being in Olympic Gardens, standing at this lamppost outside of my gate, looking up, literally looking up, you know, casting my high eyes onto the hills, Forest Hills, with these mansions. And what it said to me was that people not living not very far from me were living in opulence. And here I was living in squalor and poverty. And so the dreaming began, I would say, in earnest then. And the thing about all of our lives is that regardless of the situation that we find ourselves in, right, you might find yourself in your equivalent of Olympic Gardens. And as you look around, your environment might suggest that their success is not even remotely possible for you. But, you know, not far away from that is Olympic Gardens Forest Hills, where people are actually living, you know, very successful lives. And so it requires the courage, I would say, to want to step out of that familiar environment of your Olympic Gardens. And I'm not saying it's easy. It's not, if you're trying to step out of your comfort zone. But just to dare to dream that one day you could probably push yourself up to Forest Hills as well.
So how does a person, like, there you are, you're sitting under this lamppost. You're from Olympic Gardens, yet you're looking up at these incredibly, you know, million-dollar houses. And people can go one of two ways at that point. They can get inspired, or they can get a sense of, I don't know, injustice or
despair.
Victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
Or so how do people, like, is this just a choice that people make, or is somebody born with a positive mindset? Like, what do you think about that?
I think it's, we all have choices. Let's not kill ourselves, you know, I'm not saying that these choices are easy to execute. But yeah, I remember I, remember being 13 years old, and I tell the story often, you know, waking up one morning in the summer and saying to all the boys I grew up with on that lane that I lived, hey, we're not friends anymore. Kind of jarring, but it was a situation where they, when they looked upon Forest Hills, they saw a life that they could never dare aspire to. They saw themselves stuck in Olympic Gardens, and they called themselves sufferers, which even today, after all these years, feels so burdensome to me. And so at that age, I knew if I was to embrace that way of thinking, man, I'll be stuck. That is a height of frustration and despair to be in this environment and to have your dreams dulled, you know, just like dimmed. Just this idea that, you know what, the Olympic Forest Hills is not possible for you. I couldn't accept that. And so I chose not to see things the way they saw it, but to see that they're as difficult and as arduous a task as it is to get up to Forest Hills, that it was indeed possible.
So at 13, you literally separated from people who didn't believe in the dream.
I said, we're not friends anymore, man. I don't know what I was thinking, but I'm glad I did that, though, because it can be a lonely road. And that's a challenge, I think, with so many of us, regardless of where we start out in life and what our situation is. You know, we want to hang out and be cool. And sometimes that doesn't serve your interest. That doesn't support the dreams and aspirations that you have. Sometimes you really do have to, at least for a moment, separate yourself from everyone else. You know, I did that, and then I went off and I became an army officer, and then I could come back and I could hang with them because I was on my way to where I wanted to be. It is a sad thing because I believe that they also had the same opportunities and potential to do something different. They chose not to.
You just had a different outlook on life. You just had a different vision.
Blame my grandmother, man. I told you. She told me these stories.
She sounds amazing, for sure.
Yeah, she was.
So you speak to thousands of people, and many people talk to you about their dreams, their goals. But what I'm asking is, when you look at kind of the population in general today, what is the biggest problem with their dreams, their visions? Where do you see that?
You know, sadly, it's very similar to what the guys I grew up with deal with as well. You know, they're dealing with it. The idea that their current situation is all that there is for them. There's not a lot of room to grow beyond where they find themselves. And it's obviously plain wrong. They are mistaken beyond any reasonable doubt. And that's where the whole idea of dreaming and, you know, visualizing and imagining and then being willing to do the work as well. Push yourself out of your comfort zone, which is really challenging. As human beings, we love the familiar. And to aspire, to dare to even take the first step towards that thing that you have in your mind that you even remotely want to become, requires you to admit that, look, you know, where you are is not where you want to be, and it's going to be a little bit of a struggle to get to where you want to go. But, you know, you have to be willing to commit yourself to that struggle. And yes, you have to be willing to go in a path that's different from where your peers or even your family want to go.
What would you say to someone who, you know, whether they're midlife or, you know, doesn't really matter what age they are, but let's say they're in this mode of thinking like, I'm not sure what I want to do, but I don't think it's this. Maybe they don't like their job. Maybe they
Maybe their situation in life, they're just not happy with. At the same time, maybe they've tried goals before and they haven't worked out. So they're stuck into this place of, I don't know what I want to do. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for that person?
I've been there. You know, so the good book says, seek and you shall find. And, you know, people hear that term and or that phrase and they go, seek once. And that's not what it's suggesting. It says seek, not once or twice. So you have to keep looking, man. And so, you know, when I was in the Army, growing up, you know, if coming from where I'm coming from, if I could get to the Army Officer Corps, I would be the happiest pig in the pen, or happier than a pig in slob, you know? And then I get there and I realize that there was so much more out there to accomplish, but I didn't know what that was or what it would look like. And so I just kept seeking. I kept asking myself, what else could I do? And so we all come to that crossroad where life isn't as satisfying as we thought it would be or would like it to be. We believe that there is something else out there for us. What that something is, we don't know. You got to go seek for it. You got to go ask, keep searching your soul and your heart and your mind until it, I mean, the first idea that comes to you may not be where you end up, but it's the path. It's putting you on the path to that thing which you're searching for.
Now, when it comes to, I want to go to the Olympics for a moment, because there's going to be some people, especially if you're a younger viewer, you may have thought that Jamaica's always had a bobsled team, but that's not true. I remember when Jamaica first announced that it was going to have a bobsled team, and it was big news around the world because everybody thought, how can Jamaica even have a bobsled team? But do you want to just tell us briefly, like, how that even came to be and how did you get in to be one of the four men?
Yeah, I'm. My reaction to that news was not dissimilar from yours either. I was in the Army. It was a Friday in the summer of 1987. I'm at the battalion headquarters. I was on duty. The clerk comes in with a stack of mail to include something we call force orders. It's a newsletter, essentially, only more important. And I'm reading through it, and it comes to this bit, the bit on sports, and they're talking about you know, people who are interested in, and I quote, undergoing dangerous and rigorous training to represent Jamaica at the upcoming Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada, should make themselves known. Never heard of this place called Calgary before. Knew that bobsledding was a winter sport, so it was fast and dangerous. And I'm thinking, but this is ridiculous. I mean, it is summer of 87. The Olympics are in February of 88. How in the world are you going to train a bobsled team in Jamaica, I'm thinking. And I remember saying, this has to be the most ridiculous idea ever conceived by man. Nobody can get me to go on one of those things. Until my colonel, quote unquote, suggested that I tried out for the team. So now that I'm going to the team trials, because the colonel told me to go to the team trials, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I know I have to make this team. Because I'm just not wired to be an also ran to go, yeah, and I went to the bobsled team. It was fun. So, dude, I didn't think I was what I would call sports fit. I was army fit, and I'd spent the last 2 years training, doing army stuff, so I could walk 100 miles with 50 pounds on my back and a rifle in my hand. I didn't think I was sports fit, so I just went there. And I, again, just tried my darnest, and yeah, they like my that the smile got them again, man, and they selected me to as one of the first four to spearhead the effort of ushering Jamaica into the world of winter sports.
I didn't realize the window was so short. I mean, athletes trained 4 years to go to the Olympics, and they took a bunch of Jamaican guys, and less than 6 months' notice, you were at the Olympics.
It's, you know, so when people talk about the movie, I often say to them, you know, that to be honest, the true story is even more remarkable than what's portrayed in the movie. It's just that I get it. Hollywood, it's entertainment. And sometimes when fact is stranger than fiction, right? If you tell it like it is, people go, come on, who are you trying to fool? That could never happen. Well, yes, our story is as ridiculous as it sounds, you know, as they come anyway.
I don't know if you know this, but I was in Calgary at the time. I was a college student in the University of Calgary. Oh. Actually, all of us students had to give
up. Was I staying in your dorm?
You might have been, because we all had to give up our dorm. That would be wild if you were. Yeah. I still remember it was like there were two major stories of that games. The Jamaican bobsled team and Eddie the Eagle, yeah, the guy from England who was the...
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
But so many people were caught up in your guys' story. And I still remember everyone going to the bars, the pubs to watch you guys race. And then, you know, sadly, you guys crashed on that last race. And everyone, there was just a collective sadness. Like everyone was behind you. It's so inspiring what you guys did.
You know, I remember when, you know, crashing initially and thinking to myself, wow, how embarrassing this is happening in front of the entire world. You know, it was just not the way we wanted to go out. And then as we're walking down the braking stretch, I remember one guy reached over to shake my hand and I shook it. And then I had to shake every other hand and people are just cheering and saying, we love you, we love you. It was the crash itself was the lowest point of the experience. But the spectators there, the Calgarians there that day, you know, at least for a brief minute, made us feel good. So totally appreciate that.
It was an amazing story. You said once, I don't know how to quit. And how do we get there? I have two questions. How do we get there? But also, is there a time to call it quits?
Good. Let me answer the second one first. I think so. Okay. As much as I don't know how to quit, and I talk about that, you know, like you have to keep on pushing. You can't give up. Don't give up. I want people to know that successful people persist. The persistent ones give up all the time, not on their goals, but on the strategy, on the tactics, the things that they're using or doing to try and achieve the goal. You know, there's a big difference between being stubborn and being persistent. You know, the stubborn guy will not quit either, or the stubborn girl, but they keep doing the same thing over and over again, hitting their head against the wall. You're not going to get different results. Persistence requires a certain amount of wisdom. And I wish I knew how to teach you to have wisdom, but I don't. You just have to recognize. So the analogy I use is you leave your house to go to a particular address and you come up on a stop sign, a dead end, a detour, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What do? You adjust your route. You take another set of left and right turns that you weren't planning to take initially until you get to your destination. And it's the same thing, the same principle when it comes on to your goals. Now, if you practice that, the thing about persistence is it's a little bit like a muscle. The more you work a muscle, the stronger it gets, right? The more you practice being persistent, the more you practice not quitting on your goal, but learning how to use different routes to get to your goal, the more persistent you get. And it creates this upward spiral where you eventually just have this belief in yourself, this confidence that, you know what, this is a goal. I don't care how difficult it is. I'm going to go get it done. And you intuitively know that there are going to be some obstacles and some setbacks, and you push through and you become more confident in your abilities. And the more confident you are in your abilities, the more persistent you'll become as well. And you create this upward spiral to the point where, yeah, other people will say of you, or more importantly, you will believe of yourself, man, I'm not going to quit. This is what I want. One of the things about me is that I am unwilling to do without that which I want. So I go for
it. I love that. Can you say that again?
Yeah, I am really unwilling. It might take me a while, and I get it's going to take me a while, but I am unwilling. I'm just unwilling to do without that which I want.
I love that.
And if I quit, I'm not going to get it.
I love that. I heard you say that, first of all, I just want to make a comment. I hadn't heard anyone say quite like you did about Successful people quit all the time, but it's on strategy, but they don't quit on their goal. Mm. And I love what you said about the self-belief part, because I think that's so important when it comes to us not quitting. It's that belief in self that, hey, I can do this. And you said something from stage. You said, you were talking about comfort zones, and you said, we've got to find comfort in discomfort. How do we do that?
Ooh, with much difficulty. It is just recognizing that, man, you know what? This goal that I have, if I don't go through this pain of change, if I don't deal with this discomfort, that goal will be a fleeting illusion. And so, because I joke around a lot, my friend, you know, people, when I tell them this, I think I'm kidding, but I am not kidding. I am scared of speed and height. And, yeah, I am a bobsledder though, and I've jumped out of a plane. Don't hold it against me. I used to be young and foolish. Okay, fine. But dude, I remember my first bobsled run in Calgary there. We were starting from the half mile, halfway up the track. That's generally how it's done when you're a novice. But I'm crawling in a sled behind a guy who had never driven a sled before. And I mean, I am scared to death. I don't know what to do with myself. I tighten my chin strap. It's like it's choking me. I loosen it. I'm like, it's too loose. You know, it's going back and forth. But I just resigned myself. I remember saying to myself, you know, if I die, I die. But I'm going. And that was the commitment I made, that no matter what happened, I'm going. And so I went, still scared. We did three runs that night. I was still scared on the third run, but I was hooked. And, you know, and you have, and so you kind of get used to going from the half mile and you're, you know, a little comfortable now. And then you go three quarters up and then you go to the top. And the whole process starts over again. It just never ends.
That's such a good analogy about how to step into fear, and that you guys started at the half, and even that was scary, but then from there you continued to scale up. I've been on that track. I signed up for a skeleton sledding course, and we did the same thing. We started at halfway, then three quarters. And I can tell you, when they put me on that sled at the top, and then they pushed me, I was so afraid because I felt so out of control at that moment that like, what's going to happen to me? And of course, by the time I got to the bottom, I was hooked too. It was an incredible rush.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, skeleton is just insane, right? I don't want any part of that. Like I said, Bob said, nobody could get me to go on one of those things. Nobody's getting me to go on a skeleton sled. But you're right though. You start out just being like, so scared out of your wits. But when you cross that finish line, the exhilaration that you feel is simply amazing because you did it, right? You threw caution to the wind within reason, right? You just committed to this thing. And and that's what it feels like, whatever the goal is.
Do you have a mantra or something you say to yourself when you get into tough situations now that helps you push, keep on pushing?
I was about to say, keep on pushing. I say, yes, I can, a lot to myself. I just say, yes, I can. It's like, can you do this? It's like, if you can imagine a football coach screaming in your ears, can you do this? And then I'm responding, yes, I can, you know, kind of thing. Beyond that though, I like to use the analogy of Eric Spoelstra, the coach of the New York Heat, sorry, the Miami Heat. And I used to watch them a lot when the big three were playing, James, Wade, and Bosch. And there were certain games, and as I'm watching them in the huddle, and he would say, hey, you have to embrace the challenge. And so you have to make, when you're going through challenges, when you're facing tough times, you have to make that emotional commitment. And it's more powerful than any words that you could say to yourself. You're just like, you're in it. Like, kind of like I'm making that commitment on that bobsled run. If I die, I die. It's an emotional commitment that you're making, that Hey, I don't know how this thing is going to work out, but it's going to work out. That's it. That is as scientific as I can get.
But it's obviously worked for you, which is fantastic. Again, three-time Olympian. The first time you had 6 months training in a dangerous sport, and you just continue to throw yourself into things. You know, as we close out, I want to take you back to the story that had the biggest impact on me. And it was not, you didn't tell this from stage. You were just telling us over lunch when we were in Jamaica. You were talking about how, I think you were in Albertville. I think you had just competed in the Olympics. You're being interviewed, you know, on TV. It's going all around the world. Then you hop on a flight back to Jamaica. And like the very next day, you're in the streets of Kingston at night on some second floor. Do you remember telling this story?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, the story of my life, man. Love it. Absolutely loved it. So I talk all the time that, you know, in a way, my bobsledding was an extension of my army service. I was a serving my country. I just happened to be competing at the Olympics doing this crazy sport called bobsledding. But I would literally take my army uniform, my bobsled uniform off, put my army uniform on, and went back to work. And 1992, after the Olympics, was no different. Things were kind of heated on the streets, and I was excited, and I jumped in my uniform, and I planned this operation, and I was in one of the tougher neighborhoods with some soldiers, and 3 o'clock in the morning, I was in this kind of old abandoned building. Excuse me, and I look out and I saw these men coming across the street behind where I had a group of soldiers, and I jumped on the radio, called the sergeants, and hey, sir, some men are coming up behind you. And by the time the radio transmission was completed, there were gunshots, you know. Long story short, I remember because it was pitch black and I was trying to crawl from where I was to the sergeant's position. And like, I'm breaking every rule in the book, right? I'm shouting, like totally giving away my position, but I couldn't get him on the radio. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And it was this open kind of compound with open lot with mounds of dirt and garbage. And I'm like, one of the guys could be in here right now and hear me shouting and shoot me. And then I kind of, as I'm lying there, just kind of pause and smile to myself. I'm like, my God, what a life. I was just on TV in front of the world a couple of days ago, and here I am. I could get killed in this nondescript, empty lot. But yeah, man, those are the things that make life fun. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy both aspects, you know, being on TV in front of the world, serving my country, and being in this nondescript, empty lot. You know, with my both of them, my life on the line. Yet I told you I used to be young and foolish.
You know, it's actually a parallel of so many people's lives where they've got their job that pays the bills and they don't always like parts of the job, but then they have this vision to do something greater. Mm-hmm. It's like you had this, not to say that your service in the army wasn't great, it's amazing what you were doing, but you had these two worlds that you lived in. And that's okay. We can have great visions to do something outside of our work. We don't even have to quit our job to do something amazing and to do something great and to follow our dreams.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Absolutely. I mean, I was just very fortunate because I was living two dreams at once. You know, I had this dream of being an army officer and I had this dream of being an Olympian. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. And I've never thought of it in those terms until this very moment. But yeah, I was living two dreams at once, man. Hey, life is great.
It is great. And it was great to hang out with you for a day in Jamaica. I hope we get to do that again. And I just want to close out by saying this for a moment. You know, here at Slightly Off Course, we talk a lot about the hero's journey and how we're summoned to a grand adventure. And often we refuse that call. But then once we do, it takes us into a place that challenges us to the core, and we're forced to either grow or die in the process. And then once we do and we evolve, we come back and we bring our elixir to the tribe, right? We share our wisdom mm-hmm. back with the tribe, and that makes the tribe stronger. And that's how I see your life. I see your life in that way, that you have gone through all this road, this journey, which hasn't been easy. And yet now you've come back to the tribe and you're sharing your wisdom. You're inspiring so many people. You've been an inspiration to me. And I want to thank you for your time today, Devin. It's been great to have you on the show.
My friend, it's been awesome to be here on the show with you, hanging out. It's been too long, but thankfully, we have some technology that we can use to connect. And I just want to encourage your audience to keep tuned in, man, because you are putting out some really good content, so doing some really good work in the world, and it deserves an audience. So I want to thank everyone in advance for not just listening to this episode, but all the others.
Thank you, sir. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed my sit down with Devin, and there are so many things that struck me in that interview, but I think most of all was his statement, "I am unwilling to do without that which I want." And it's that kind of attitude paired with the resilient message of keep on pushing that has made him such an inspiration. And if there's a goal in your life or something that you really wanted to go after, but you've backed off a bit, or maybe you've even begun to doubt that it can happen, then I hope Devin's word inspires you to recommit and to keep on pushing. If you would like more information on Devin, you can find links to his website in the show notes at jamesrobbins.com/episode-4. Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks for coming. And I would love for you to connect with us on Instagram. You can find us over there at Slightly Off Course Podcast. And in the next episode, I'll be reading out some of the reviews left on iTunes about the show. So if you'd like a shout out, make sure you go to iTunes and let us know what you think. Until next time, I'm James Robbins, and this is Slightly Off Course.